If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. About one out of every six public school students in Baltimore attends a charter school, but tensions between the charters and the school district are high. The ongoing dispute over what share of public school money should go to charters led five operators of charter schools to file suit against city schools 3 weeks ago. This week, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake asked former Mayor Kurt Schmoke, now president of the University of Baltimore, to facilitate discussions between the two sides. And school CEO Gregory Thornton withdrew his latest funding plan for charters. With us to talk about the concerns of charter schools in Baltimore is Bobby McDonald, executive director of City Neighbors Foundation. It operates three independent charter schools in northeast Baltimore and is one of the five charter school operators representing eight schools that filed a lawsuit. Welcome to the show, Bobby.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We asked to speak to someone from this school system, but they declined. Bobby, what is the simplest way to describe what the charter schools are upset about in the school system's budgeting plans?
Well, since, the charter school law passed in 2003.
And since the state law.
The state law. And since then, you know, that gave folks the ability to gather together and create a charter and have it approved and then independently operate a public school in the city. And since then, there's also a statewide funding formula that was approved by the Court of Appeals back in 2007. And since then, we've worked with several administrations all using that framework for how funding works for charter schools. And that's worked well with collaboration and working
closely
together.
But I'm trying to zero in on where you disagree. We only have a few minutes,
sure.
And I want to make sure people understand what is it that the schools are proposing that you, in simplest terms, that you think does not serve the charters or is not fair to the charters?
Well, the administration needs to actually follow the state funding formula, and we've asked them to come to the table in a mediated way with transparency so that we can have a consistent and clear legal formula that's being followed, because right now they've abandoned that formula.
You're saying that the Baltimore public schools are not following the formula in state law?
That's right. And the formula that they proposed a couple weeks ago was so far off of it that a lot of great people came together and there was an outcry because the implications of that formula was really a disaster for Baltimore. So
I'm sorry, when you say the implications of the formula would have been a disaster, tell me specifically what you mean.
So the school system proposed a formula to use for next year. And that formula, that proposed formula, was not aligned with the state law and instead had a structure that allowed, that would cause the closure of about 13 schools, that had a redistribution of money, that held money back at central office. It had a lot of implications that would really have hurt a lot of what's happening that's great in our school system right now.
So are you saying, I think I have read that
that
some charter schools said they would have that would need to close under that funding formula. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying, yes, that the proposed formula that they had proposed and that they have now rescinded and pulled back would have been disastrous, and that there's a state law and a funding formula that exists that they need to follow.
Okay, and I have the impression we're not going to sort it out in this short interview, I'm sure, but I have the impression that the law calls for a certain amount of per pupil funding from which the authorizing body, in this case the Baltimore Public Schools, are allowed to withhold money for services and activities that will be covered by the central school district. It is my impression, you can tell me if I'm wrong, that the most expensive of those is special education, that the city withholds a lot of money for special education. That's one reason that the funding per pupil in charter schools is something around $9,000.
May I just say how it works? The way the funding works for charters is that all students in Baltimore City have a tuition, and that's about $15,000. And then the way the formula works is you first identify all the revenue coming in, you take off the shared expenses, the debt service, you take out any restricted funds, including special ed restricted funds, and then the city also takes out another 2%, and that's about $20 million for being the authorizer of charter schools. And then what's left, the charter schools, and they call that the per pupil, have power to decide how that money is spent. In a traditional school, what's left, and it's the same amount of that per pupil, central office holds a certain amount of it in services and gives some cash to the schools. That is how the funding formula works for charter schools.
That's Bobbi Brown here on WIPR Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. She is executive director of City Neighbors Foundation, which is one of the charter school operators that has filed suit against the central school system. I have the impression that Baltimore City is talking about withholding more money than you think is fair. And some other school districts in the state, like Anne Arundel, I think, withholds a smaller amount and then expects the charter schools to cover some of those services for which it has not withheld money. Mm-hmm. And I'm asking whether you think that's a better approach.
I think that the best approach is for it to be a transparent and consistent process. And no one's making this up. The money doesn't belong to the school system. It doesn't belong to charter schools. It belongs to the students. And so that's why they need to come to the table. There has to be a transparency. Let's open the books. Let's see how it goes. And whatever is right, that's what we're committed to doing.
Well, the implication of what you told me a few minutes ago, it seems, about the way the city schools has approached this would imply that they're not interested in the charter schools being successful. Is that how you see it?
You know, they've said, just to use their own terms, they've invited us to two conversations so far, in my experience, in the past month, Sheila. So the first conversation, they began by introducing a formula that would close my three schools for sure and impact negatively at least another 8, 9, 10 charter schools in Baltimore. The second conversation, they began by introducing an announcement saying, you know, that we've dropped the lawsuit, that we've agreed to negotiations, and none of that was true either. So far, in terms of my confidence in having a trusted partner and coming to the table, I am having some difficulty saying that they care about charter schools.
And why do you think then, in your view, again, we don't have the city schools with us in this conversation, In your view, why would that be? When Baltimore has so many, Baltimore has more charter schools, as you know, it has about 3/4 of all the charter schools mm-hmm. in the state, certainly far more than any other jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Why would they not be committed to your success?
If we just take a look at that for a second, the charter schools in Baltimore are really grassroots groups. You know, they're all neighborhood groups that have come together with this idea of what could be a great public school. And I think, you know, if we just consider for a second what we're doing, I mean, the role of charters in Maryland and Baltimore is really to push back on the system and to ask them to work in a different way. And in this struggle, what is being highlighted is that, you know, capable and passionate educators and parents can come together to run schools and get great results for kids without a top-heavy system trying to run them. And that's uncomfortable for an entrenched system. And following the law.
And that probably is the answer to my question. I'm sorry, we're out of time. This is a short conversation. Obviously, there's a lot more that we should talk about. I really appreciate your coming in to talk to us.
Thank you so much for having me. We're going to have a great rally tomorrow morning at 10:30 at Lake Montebello. And you can see the families and children and teachers who care passionately about education out there tomorrow morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bobbi McDonald, she's executive director of City Neighbors Foundation, which operates 3 independent charter schools in Northeast Baltimore.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
And thanks, Nathan. Thanks again to everybody who has contributed so far in our fall membership campaign. We really appreciate the help. We really appreciate the support. If you haven't gotten around to doing it, why don't you call 410-235-1395. Make your pledge. Become a sustaining member. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. The Baltimore Book Festival begins in about, well, a little less than 2 hours from now down at the Inner Harbor in Baltimore. There are various stages set up along the waterfront promenade. You've got the City Lit stage, the Food for Thought stage, the Health and Wellness stage, the Ivy Bookshop stage, and several others, including the Enoch Pratt Free Libraries Children's stage. And among those gracing that stage tomorrow and Sunday are my guests this morning, Maria Broom and Laurel Snyder. Laurel Snyder grew up in Baltimore. She lives in Atlanta now. She's the author of 5 novels for children, as well as several picture books and 2 volumes of poetry. Her latest picture book is called Swan, The Life and Dance of Anna Pavlova. Now, Maria Broom, and I've said this before, and I will say it again, she is a treasure in our community. She's an actress with many television and stage credits, a storyteller, a teacher, a dancer. She's a former reporter, a Fulbright Award winner, along with many, many other awards. And now she can add to that illustrious list an author. Her book for children is called The Village Bully. Maria Broom and Laurel Snyder join me this morning in Studio A. Good morning. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Miss Maria, as you are known and beloved by generations of kids and grown-ups alike, The Village Bully tells the story of Michael Jose Jamal. About a year ago, you and I were at the OSI Big Change Forum, the Open Society Institute, of which you are a former fellow. They had these things called Big Change Forums. They've done a couple of them, and I've been very blessed to be asked to moderate both of those. And you performed the book, The Village Bully, for that audience, and blew people away. I mean, it just captivated the room, as you have captivated so many rooms in your career. I wonder if we could start by your giving us a taste of The Village Bully right from the beginning of the book.
Be my pleasure. Michael Jose Jamal was bigger than most of the boys. He was taller than his dad. He always seemed mad, and he liked making whole lots of noise. He loved his grandmother, who moved far away. He had a little sister, but she died one day. His mother was sad and got very sick. His father was around, but they just didn't click. He stayed to himself almost all of the time, and he knew only one way to get a dollar or a dime. Looking mean, he would say, "Give me what you got. Give it to me now, or I'll hurt you a lot."
Michael Jose Jamal, we learned so much about him in just the first couple of pages of this beautifully illustrated book. The plot of this book, as it were, is based on a tradition in African villages of dealing with kids like Michael Jose. Tell us where this, the genesis for this story comes from.
I had read an article about a decade ago about a village in Africa, I think the Babemba tribe, I think is the name of it, that when someone in the village did something very wrong, something hurtful or damaging, everything would stop, all work would stop. And the villagers would create this huge circle around the person that had done the deed. And one by one, each person in that circle would say something positive, something good that they knew about that person from the time he was born up until the present day. It took hours, sometimes days. And what they were actually doing was creating a circle of love, a circle of mirrors to remind that person who he really is. And then, of course, by the end of the days or the hours, there was this reconciliation and the person remembered and he was forgiven and he actually could offer some sort of apology or whatnot. So I thought, what a great concept, but how could we do something like that here in America where we really promote and make money off of punishment? So I thought, if we started with the children, so this story poem came through, The Village Bully, and I now present it to schools and to children and to clubs and to Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Freedom Schools, so that the children can actually do it for themselves, and with the hopes that we would grow a whole generation of people that would do more healing instead of punishing. And I saw its effectiveness because so many of the children themselves have been hurt. They grow up in families and in neighborhoods and communities where it's punishing for them to live and grow up in those families and neighborhoods. So for other children to see the good things in them and to call it out, to affirm them, it was healing.
Sure. And of course, you know, the amount of PTSD, the amount of depression, the amount of mental health problems that some of these children are dealing with if they're living in neighborhoods and in households that are, you know, such rough going, that doesn't get thought about a lot. Yeah. And when people talk about bullying, they talk about the person who is bullied.
Exactly.
They very rarely talk about the reasons behind the person doing the bullying.
Right. And yeah. they're the ones that need the healing. And if you don't start it with the healing with the children, then it grows up to they grow up to be teenagers who are actively bullying and hurting, and then you grow up to be adults who have this wall around them and they're hurting others.
Sure. And Laurel Snyder, your book is about a very famous ballerina from Russia, Anna Pavlova. Mm-hmm. Talk about Anna's significance to the art of ballet.
Well, so, I mean, her significance to ballet is that she was and sort of remains the most famous ballerina of all time. But more importantly, when she was dancing, when she began to dance, she began as a very poor child in White Russia. And it was this insane stroke of luck that she ended up in the Imperial Dance School and sort of took that experience of having come from this place of poverty and then ended up in these amazing places. And at that time, ballet was really something that existed only for the very wealthy in European capitals. And so Pavlova kind of said, well, this has transformed my life. Everybody deserves to have this in their lives. And so she went and, I mean, just got on steamships and packed up her group and, I mean, packed up like portable dance floors and went to, you know, dirt floors in Mexico. And I mean, she went to Australia and she went to, you know, Japan and she went to India and she traveled the world and kind of brought dance to places that didn't have a place, didn't even have a venue for something like that, and introduced it. So really, I feel like when I was a dance student myself as a child, when I look at dancers, when I go to do events around the country now for this book, what I want to say to them is there would be no dance school in Iowa or Georgia or wherever I am if it weren't for Pavlova or someone like her. So.
Yeah. I had the great good fortune, again, another wonderful blessing, to find myself vacationing in St. Petersburg, Russia, this summer. And I went to the Mariinsky Theater and saw the Mariinsky Ballet. And I'll tell you, the Russians, they take their ballet pretty seriously.
It's a whole different thing.
I mean, there are superstars the way we have, you know, Beyonce and Jay-Z are superstars. The ballerinas in Russia are superstars.
Absolutely. So,
and this is a marvelous, marvelous story. And Maria Broom, you mentioned that you have used this in workshops. You've used the Village Bully in workshops. You actually also have been doing workshops for years on stress management for children.
That's true.
You know, and again, God bless for recognizing and understanding that kids are stressed. I mean, I think grown-ups tend to think, well, what's stressful about being a kid? You're just a kid. You know, it's easy. You know, wait till you get in the real world. You know? But there are things that children can do, and reading books like this is one of them. What are some of the other techniques that you employ to help children relieve this stress that they clearly feel?
Every class that I teach, in any public school, private school, always starts with the circle of silence. The children have to take their shoes off. And we sit in this big circle, and we do this deep breathing. And then we get to just open our hearts, and I pass around a little bell that they can hold in their hands. And I said, when it comes to you, send love wherever you want it to go. They are so excited about doing that. It's empowering to them to think that what I think and what I say out of my mouth will actually help somebody in Africa, in India, in Japan, or my grandmother in the hospital, or my father who's away at war. Just this whole idea of coming into your heart, doing deep breathing. With the older students, the teenagers, we sit in that circle of silence and we do a lot of self-forgiveness. Forgive yourself. Forgive yourself. Children grow up with so much guilt, especially once they get to be teenagers, about what they think they've done that's wrong. And so, and they carry it like little pebbles. And I keep saying, take these pebbles, take them off one by one, forgive yourself, and then forgive somebody who did something wrong to you, whether it was a sibling, a parent, or a friend, or a stranger. So just these little techniques, children are really very, very, they're much like sponges and welcoming for exercises that use their spirit, their heart, and their mind, you know. They're just as welcoming for that as they are for games and sports. but it has to be offered to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In a genuine way.
In a genuine way that they like and that's different, you know.
Yeah. One of the things that interested me about your book, Laurel, is that it's got a sad ending.
Yes, it does.
And a spoiler alert for the parents who are thinking about getting this for their kids, but Anna Pavlova, of course, like all of us, passes away. And it's interesting. I was thinking about, you know, were I reading this to my kid, who's now 27 years old and doesn't let me read to her anymore, but, you know, good night story, a good night, you know, before bedtime story. What do you think about the impact of that on children?
I think that sometimes we just do children a disrespect. I mean, it's not unlike what Maria was just saying. We have a sense of what we as adults imagine children can do and handle and you know, sort of encompass. And we have an idea of what a book should be for them. We have an idea for what an activity should be for them, for what a song should be for them. And then, you know, we're listening to adult music in the car and your kid loves it. And you go, oh, yeah, you can love all music, not just children's music. I think that something has happened in picture books where we forget what children go through. Children are sad all the time. Children are angry all the time. Children have a huge range of emotion. Mm. And if we produce a literature for them that doesn't reveal that, that doesn't show that, that's just sort of all happy bunnies wandering around in the field, that's because we need to believe that that's what childhood is, not because that's what children actually can handle. And it's been really interesting as I do these events. It was her death was beautiful and her life was well lived. And I feel like we can't expect more in life than to accomplish what she accomplished and die well and loved and surrounded by our accomplishments. And so I felt like it was a great place to showcase not a book about death to help children deal with death, but to just make it clear that like a life well lived ends and then their legacy continues beyond that, which is what Pavlova's story tells us. And admittedly, I wouldn't intend this book for a 2-year-old necessarily. Like, it's really an older reader's picture book and a poem and art. But I it was very, very important to me that I couldn't do this book unless I found an editor who could let me include the death scene. And my experience has been that when I go to do events with kids, it's astounding to me. I read it, and then we get to a point where the kids say, so she died. And I say, yeah. And they go, okay. Like, they get it. They know that
stuff
that's part
happens.
Of life. We as parents want to protect them from that awareness, but that's absurd. Children are sad all the time.
It's the same with the line, and he had a little sister, but she died one day.
And that comes right out of the gate in your book.
And the children are like,
That happens.
And that happens. And then they start asking, well, how did she die? And then they start saying, well, maybe she got shot. Or maybe she had a disease. Or maybe she fell down the step. I mean, they just...
And they own the book that
they
way.
Own
it. They,
A big part of writing for children is skirting their parents. Is getting around their parents and to them.
Exactly. Maria Broom's book is called The Village Bully. Laurel Snyder's is called Swan, The Life and Dance of Anna Pavlova. Maria Broom will be appearing at the Baltimore Book Festival tomorrow at noon. Laurel Snyder will present her book at the festival on Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock. It begins this morning at 11 o'clock at Baltimore's Inner Harbor. We've got a link to the complete schedule on our website, WIPR.org. Thanks to you both.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
And now we take a listen to the Baltimore-based musician Danny Greenwald. His one-man band is called Glassine, and the new album, No Stairway, is comprised solely of manipulated field recordings captured inside music stores in Brooklyn, New York, and in Baltimore. Danny Greenwald sat down with our producer, Jonna McCone, to talk about the album.
My name is Danny Greenwald. I'm 30 years old. I am the band master of this project called Glassine. I'm from Columbia, Maryland. I live in Baltimore. My mom's name is Donna. I recorded an album called No Stairway, and it consists of manipulated and sampled field recordings that I took from inside of the chain store called Guitar Center.
Mm-hmm.
The idea for the album came from my lack of money and resources when I was living in New York City. I'm a musician, and so I'm generally always recording, except for right now. And so I was thinking, like, how am I going to make the most out of nothing? I didn't want to use, like, samples that came with, like, a certain program. I didn't want to use, like, a laptop for really no reason. That's sort of, like, an arrogant notion. I think there's a lot of really good music that comes from that sort of process. And then I went to a guitar center to get nothing. I think I was just bored, and I was in Atlantic Center Terminal. I think I was waiting for a train or something, and I heard somebody, a Green Day song or something, but the tone of the guitar was just, like, awful. And I remember thinking, like, what if I could feed that through these weird reverb pedals I have at home? Like, would it sound any different? And then it sort of just hit me, like, why don't I just record other people playing and then sort of use those as my paint? I was really just recording what sounded useful. So it wasn't like I was walking around the store and I was like, now I need to get guitar for this part of this song, or now I need to get drums for, you know, the rhythm for this part of the song. It was more like I hear some sort of, like, sonic quality that in my head I could manipulate into something more pleasing than what was coming out of the amplifier or coming off of the drum kit or whatever, and I would sort of gravitate toward sounds rather than instruments. Quality about the record that I want to preserve is that it's sort of like this landscape and you don't really know where it is. I mean, you do know where it is if you know anything about the background of the record, but if you had never read anything about the record or whatever and you're, like, picturing somewhere in your mind, it's like there's really no actual landscape. If I had to describe the sound of the album, I would say it's kind of like a drizzle on top of, like, a really small Honda Civic if you're, like, driving through Alaska, if Alaska was located on another planet, and also you had, like, a broken AM radio that's sort of cutting in and out of an R&B station that you don't really want to hear because your tape machine is busted and you really just want to listen to Rent.
Danny Greenwald is the one-man band called Glassine. He spoke with Marilyn Morning producer Jonna McCone about his album No Stairway. The album was released on the Patient Sounds record label. We're looking for more musicians to profile here on Marilyn Morning. If you've got a suggestion for folks that we can feature, drop us a note at mdmorning@wypr.org. You can listen to more of Danny's album at glassinemusic.bandcamp.com.